You're listening to DraftKings Network.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Big Suey, presented by DraftKings.
Why are you listening to this show?
The podcast that seems very similar to the other Dan Le Batard podcast.
I'm sorry, I'm not going to apologize for that.
In fact, the only difference seems to be this imaging.
I have been tempted in restaurants just walking past tables to grab somebody's fries that if they're just there. That hasn't happened to you guys?
I've done it.
And now, here's the marching man to nowhere, Fat Face, and the habitual liar.
Welcome to Meadowlarkers 17. Kate Fagan and Amin El-Hassan will join in a moment. I'm Howard Bryant. We're calling this episode The Stone Tablets, because that's how we treat rules, as edicts passed down from the heavens, and not ever-evolving documents that reflect current times and customs, and thus should always be questioned and can always be changed. In America, we treat rules with a certain duality, deference, and powerlessness. Some states allow you to legally kill other people if you feel threatened. Why? Because that's the law. Why do homeowners receive credit on their taxes, but renters don't? Because that's the way it is. The rules say if 49% of the public votes for a losing candidate, they get nothing. And yet, we treat voting as if it's the most representative form of action. There's a reason why Sartre called elections a trap for fools. In sports, this was on full display most prominently last weekend. The Chiefs and the Bills played an epic divisional playoff. The Chiefs won, and when the NFL's inadequate overtime rules became part of the story, so much of the response was not to interrogate the rules, but to relitigate the game. Get a stop, Buffalo, and we're not even talking about overtime. Insert eye roll emoji here. But we'll get back to the NFL in a minute. So many of the rules in place are taken with acceptance. They're treated as immutable. Once when I'd reached my breaking point with the NBA star system of officiating, I proposed the NBA do away completely with foul outs, that the game had outgrown its rules. The supposed non-contact sport was now too physical, too vertical, too fast to be governed by six fouls. And I was laughed out of the building for that, even though in baseball a walk was once eight balls instead of four. In college basketball, dunks were once illegal. And in women's basketball, there was a time when some of the players weren't even allowed to cross half court. The point is that things change, and they're supposed to. The implementation of rules is inherently accepted as motivated by fairness, even though fairness is very much in the eye of the beholder, heavily influenced by who's in charge. Don't get me started on the fairness of SAT scores, or salary caps, or revenue sharing. So, do we change the rules in pursuit of the more perfect union? The fairest competition, the most equitable outcomes, or are rules simply for the rulers to keep the winners winning? Kate, let's start with you. I mean, I understand part of this. I know that rules give us a sense of structure. They give us balance and authority, and they also absolve us from doing a lot of thinking and from challenging. But rules also put us in our place. And where does this conversation take you?
I think you laid it out so nicely in that essay to start, Howard, because the way that I think about rules, and for a long time I kind of thought about rules as like they didn't come necessarily from people per se, therefore they could have biases, right? They were rules. They were written things, and I like to use the word immutable. And then, you know, especially playing women's sports, you start to kind of like arch an eyebrow at the way rules come about and come into play. And I started to kind of land in this place where I'm like, the rules are both a reflection of society and they reinforce society at that certain time that they are made. And, you know, I think zooming out to like the historical viewpoint, as you alluded to in the piece, is a great place to start. Because you even mentioned, you know, like women's basketball, there was a time when you couldn't cross half court. if you go back even farther to just the first few years after Naismith invents the game, the way that basketball was played in many places when women played it was that as many women were on the court, there were boxes for those women. So if you had a game with 11 players, you had 11 boxes on the court. And you couldn't leave that box.
Can I stop you right there for just a quick second? Because I remember this when I was a kid, and I'm not that old, but I remember those structures. Like when you looked at the old basketball books, you saw like they had the section for the women's game, and you could see these spaces where you couldn't move. It was like you were playing Foursquare. But here's something that I don't know. What was the rationale for that?
Put these women in their places.
Yeah, well, literally put them in their places. But like the age-old rationale that permeates so much of the rules and regulations in women's sports, which is let us make this less rigorous for women. It can't possibly be that women could run even half of a court's length. Mm. And we don't want it getting too physical, because when women were first starting to play basketball in that like squishy period when Naismith publishes the rules and Clara Bayer and Sanda Berenson haven't like modified them to women's rules. Of course, there are women who are getting physical in trying to take the ball from one another, and we couldn't have that. So it was like both this like rigorous and this physicality to make it quote unquote ladylike. And I think even using that as an example of, we should always be looking at the rules of our game as in a historical context of, at the moment they're created, they are reflecting and reinforcing society, and they exist at that time based on the evolution of where both humanity is and the human body is. And I've thought about that as someone who played women's basketball. Of course, I think about the rules that exist in that all the time. And then also as someone who covered the NBA, feeling like there are some parts of this game that shouldn't be rigid anymore. That shouldn't be, as you said, Howard, immutable. Like we have evolved in so many ways, and like we need our rules to be evolving in real time.
It's funny. I was thinking about what you're saying there, Kate, and I know in Islam, obviously, there is this concept of polygamy that a man may have up to four wives. Well, the reason why it's four is that before Islam, the local tribesmen in the Arabian Peninsula routinely had 15, 20, 25 wives. And so when they came in and were spreading the faith, legend has it, they were like, they want to get it down to monogamous. And like, boss, I don't think they're going to go for that one. So this is like a middle.
It's a compromise?
Yeah, I was like, all right, can we get them down to four? Can we get it down to four? Does that work? And they're like, all right. But, you know, but otherwise.
Well, that's a big win if you can go from 15 to 25 down to four. That's a big W.
Yeah.
But the idea was that at that time in history, the idea of telling these people you were going to have struggle getting converts. Well, obviously, society's progressed since then, and that, even in and of itself, of four wives is an outdated concept. Similarly, in basketball, the other thing I was thinking about, not just things that were reflective of society at the time but don't reflect us now, but the concept of rules that were enacted with the belief that this would be the right thing to do to fix whatever problem. And then later on, we discovered, yeah, that absolutely didn't fix it. It might have made it worse. So in society, the great example of this is, was it the 19th Amendment? Prohibition. The idea that, hey, alcohol is bad. We've got all this organized crime and people are kind of late to work, whatever. We should ban alcohol. And you ban it, and instead it proliferates this black market and increases violent crime as these organized crime factions are, in essence, battling for territory and for
the
rights.
Not a temperance man.
And so what we end up doing is like, yeah, that we wanted it to accomplish something. It did the exact opposite, get rid of that rule. In basketball, an example of this would be the three-point line. Three-point shooting isn't that great. We should move it in closer. Just make it a uniform 22 feet. And they moved it in, and what happened was the people who were great shooters continue to be great shooters. But then it just, rather than get better three-point shooting across the board, what we got were people who aren't three-point shooters, like Charles Oakley, saying, I'll throw my hat in that ring. And
it's pretty close. I can do that.
Barkley was a leading three-point shooter in the mid-90s. He was taking as many threes as anybody.
Because it's like, oh, now you've made it this close? Oh, yeah, all day long. And again, so we found, that probably wasn't the way to go, and we pulled it back. And so I like the idea of rules that represent society and how we think of things at the time, but also like the idea of like sometimes they're used to address things And we figure out this doesn't work, so let's change it.
And one of the things that's interesting about the entire conversation about rules is the reason for their enactment in the first place. And I think that what we do is we go into this believing in a certain level of fairness, that we go into it ideally, that the reason is always to create fairness. That's the reason for the rule, right? Well, sometimes the reason is control. Sometimes the reason is money. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the reason is reinforcement. You were talking about the 3-point shot in the NBA, and I thought where you were going to go was the original was back in 79. The NBA stayed away from everything that the ABA was doing because the ABA was the street league. It was the ghetto league. It wasn't the cool league, right? It wasn't the reputable league.
Yes. The idea was that this isn't basketball. This is whatever those people do over there. And this is basketball. And by the way, that belief system, even as when we sit here today, you watch NBA basketball today, and you can watch ABA basketball and NBA basketball pre-merger and say, which one of these looks more familiar?
It's the
Everyone would choose ABA. Mm-hmm. But to this day, that vein of like, yeah, that's not real, exists. It's the reason why Larry Brown has 1,000 wins as opposed to 1,300 wins. You should be the third or fourth winningest coach of all time because they don't count ABA records. Because there's this always feeling of the establishment saying that was just a sham. It was just a mockery of the game. Even as today, all the best parts, a slam dunk contest, a 3-point line on the floor, improvisational freewheeling style of play. It's all our league now, but, you know, a lack and a less.
It's this idea that the rules are, first, believing that they're fair and right. It's kind of the default setting that we sometimes go into sports with, rather than actually realizing, to Howard, to your point, that you also said in the essay that, hey, often the rules are created by the winner. In the same way that history is written by the conquerors, rules are created by the winner. I mean, like, this is a silly example, but if you've ever played like a game at someone's house, like something stupid like charades, and at first you're
house
like,
rules?
You're making it up as you go along, right? You're like, can you skip ones? And first you're like, sure, you can skip them. Then somebody skips 9, and you're like, well, that's not working for me. you can only skip one. And then you'll be like, and then you get to the point where the house rules, right? You're like, if somebody is good at something and it's in their house, then the rules are structured so that they are maximizing their own potential. And the fact that we would believe that this wouldn't happen in sports, like the easy case for basketball being like, once 3-point shooting is proliferated, we are going to make sure that we structure the rules so that hand checking's not happening because this is the style of play that the winners are playing right now. And we have to make sure that the style that is selling, that we are getting higher ratings than we've ever gotten. Like, we don't want that 90s basketball to come creeping back in.
No,
it's like the winners writing those rules, right?
Oh, I feel like a winner because I don't want the 90s to come back. Final score, Pacers 69, Knicks 62.
Right.
In overtime.
This thing of like the rules being fair and right, like there's always a finite time where they're working. Whether they're fair, we'll leave that aside. But whether they're working, it's always a moving target.
Yeah.
We don't put rules in and then 40 years later, it's a rare rule, unless it's a foundational piece of a game, that is still working. And to me, the interesting thing about football, because this is the jumping off point, is the NFL games. It might just be, for NFL overtime, that there's no perfect way of doing it.
No,
I mean,
that's
we've
right.
been living that way for a very long time with soccer. Like when we get to penalty kicks, like we're all sitting there going, God, there's got to be a better way, but maybe there isn't. And that when we get to that point in a game, that's when you're kind of like, ooh, well, sports aren't just black and white. And we have always created everything to the very last second to be the most fair. Sometimes you get there and you're like, we ain't got nothing better than this.
Exactly. Well, we're going to get back to that in a quick second. But I want to stop right now and just say, in terms of house rules, yes, when you play Monopoly, the utility money goes under free parking.
Free parking. Yep.
Right? It does, doesn't it?
All the fines
go under free parking.
Yes, absolutely.
I remember playing that once, and I put the money into free parking, and some people I was playing with, they're like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm putting the money where it's supposed to go. Yeah. Everybody knows this. Right, house rules.
House rules.
Right.
House rules.
And I think that one of the things, too, and we're talking about fairness, you can't get away. It's almost like what we've been talking about the last 2 weeks previously about this illusion of meritocracy. We have this illusion of fairness. And when I think about this, I think about baseball. The rules that we watch, and it's not the baseball rules as much as it is the baseball unwritten rules. All of that comes from the pre-integration game. Baseball is played very differently across the world. You watch the way when during the pandemic, when we were watching Korean baseball, and you're seeing all the bat flips, and they play the game. They swing differently. They play differently. It's a very different style over there. You watch the Caribbean baseball. You go watch the Dominican Winter League baseball. They play with a different energy. You go, you watch Negro League baseball, different energy. But then when you come to the big leagues, Major League Baseball, white American baseball, now we're going to hit you in the head if you hit a home run off of us, right? The next guy goes down. Like, there's a totally different unwritten rule structure that baseball has been struggling with for the last 40 years about whether or not how this game is played. Is it playing the game right, or is this simply the way you play the game?
To your point, Howard, that seems to be a reflection of U.S. machismo and a reinforcement of it. This idea of, like, you're hitting people if they hit a home run and then they toss their bat too high and you don't like it. That seems to me to be like a reflection of that part of our society. I'm not saying that doesn't exist anywhere else, but, and then when you start to see it creep in and question, now the topic is, should we still be beating people in the head?
Right.
And there's almost this digging in of the heels.
Game's got to police itself, Kate.
Yeah, the digging in of the heels is like, this is what makes men men, is being able to do this.
Well, that sounds like hockey as well. Like, for example, I remember taking a girlfriend when I was living in California, and I took her to a Sharks game. And in fact, I got to see Gretzky playing for the Rangers, and fight breaks out, and she's going, they're fighting. Yes, they're fighting. And nobody's doing anything about it. I'm like, no, they're not. How can that be? I'm like, those are the rules. And once again, fighting in hockey is one of those things where if you're not a hockey person or not a sports person at all, and you just happen to like walk past the TV and you see all these guys duking it out and both benches are tapping their sticks going, yeah, good job, man, good job. What is this?
And then from a non-hockey person, like if they fall off their skates, it's over. Like, that's the rule, right? Like, who instituted that being the rule? That, like, that's
well, now they climb on top of each other, you know, and then, but once there's a little bit of separation, like the referee, the linesman, they're waiting for a moment to jump in. But generally speaking, but there's an actual rule to this. Like, there is a structure to it. Like, there is, if you drop the gloves and I don't, you're not supposed to punch me. There's an etiquette to this.
Right.
We're both supposed to drop them at the same time. And then we're supposed to duke it out. And then there had been, like, this argument, very similar to baseball in terms of, okay, if you get a little too fresh, I'm going to throw the ball at you, because this is how the game is allowed to police itself, right? That there's a structure.
Well, here's the funny thing about that. In both of those examples, both baseball and hockey, these are two sports where we can say unequivocally the best professional league in all of the world is right here in the United States. But if I said, who's the best at playing this sport? We wouldn't say the United States for either of those sports.
And never have.
And furthermore, beyond that, even now when they compete in world games, like the World Cup of baseball, like the Winter Olympics in hockey, we don't have any of those shenanigans. We don't have the unwritten rule of hitting people because they bat flip. We don't have a bunch of fights in Olympic hockey. So, like, where does this air of superiority come where it's like, no, this is how it's done, when clearly it's not done like this anywhere else?
And especially because I'm a big hockey fan. I love Olympic hockey. No fights at all. Still a great game. Still a well-policed game.
Still a great game.
It is a great game.
When you say still a great game, it has a level of like,
how can this be a good game because we don't do it?
Nobody got punched. How can you call this a good game? Right? It's crazy. It's like, actually watching people play the sport that we came here to watch them do is actually a better product than watching them fight or throw things at each other or whatever.
Well, it's the old thing. I went to a fight and a hockey game broke out.
Yeah. So, yeah, but goes back to kind of the rules. Who's making the rules? Who's upholding the rules? If the rules were made a long time ago, why do we feel an attachment to making sure they stay the same? I always talk about this with basketball. We're the baby sport. So for us, changing rules is a part of the thing. We do it all the time. We have a competition committee that sits around and says, I don't like this rule. Let's try doing this instead. That's not the case in baseball. What is it about baseball specifically that makes it so resistant to change?
History. The game's been around since the end of the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And it's been played a certain way, even though during that time period in 1889, it was eight balls to a walk. right? And then it went from 7 to 6 to 5, and ultimately they settled on 4. So kind all of polygamy. Those things, right?
creeping exactly. down.
Exactly, right? It's a good compromise. And you start to have these, you know, things become cultural. Like, it would be really interesting to look and find out at what year the rules stopped shifting and it became the game that we know now. And Amin, as much as I agree with you that basketball is the baby sport, football is the one that changes the rules all the time. I mean, if you, mm-hmm. like, the reason why people love baseball so much is the continuity that it's basically the same game, dead ball era notwithstanding. Basically the same game for the last 100 years. The bases haven't changed. The game hasn't changed. The way the game is played, most of that stuff hasn't really changed. I mean, you emphasize other things, some things over others. But basically, it's the same sport. Football, you can't tell by the decade. You change the pass interference rules, and all of a sudden, Matthew Stafford is throwing 2,000 yards a year more than Joe Montana. Right? And this is all simply structure-based. It's all just rules.
Well, it seems in that way that football has always been purposefully onto something, because you could, and probably people smarter than me probably already have made a case that football has reflected America throughout the decades in the way that it's being played. Like, no one would want to watch football now back in the 1920s when it was like, just rush the ball and there's no forward pass. And like, it's basically rugby. And you see, like, as the ball is getting aired out, and then the proliferation of, like, the passer, it's like, it feels very representative of American society, too.
It's modern, right? And that's the and that's the thing. But very little of that has anything to do with fairness as much as it has to do with excitement. It has to do with
television.
You know, and television.
Football is the television sport. And none of these changes have anything to do with, is this fair? And has everything to do with, how do we make this a better television product? It's amazing.
Hey everybody, it's Mike, and typically I record these Miller Lite spots in the studio, but I requested that I specifically record this one from my home office because I got a window and I'm looking outside at those beautiful fishtail palms, knowing that in just a few seconds, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to crack open a can of Miller Lite, because while sitting outside by my fishtail palms is usually a good time, I like to take it up a notch and make it a Miller time. That's right, you crack that puppy open and you don't have to think about what you're drinking for a darn second. A lot has changed over the years, including my backyard. Lots of landscaping being done right now. But the one thing that hasn't changed is the undebatable quality of Miller Lite. You don't have to choose what quality is the best. Miller Lite has great taste, and it's less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces, fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.
Switching gears a little quickly on this too, is that I remember bringing up my radical idea that basketball had outgrown itself, that basketball had outgrown its rules. If you go back to the founding fathers, to the down the street in Springfield, nobody had ever anticipated basketball being as fast, as physical, as vertical as it became. And I was thinking, like, name me another sport where you get disqualified for a routine infraction. That would be like losing your left tackle because you got called for holding 3 times. It's like, this just needs to change. And especially because of the star system. You knew that in the last 6 or 7 minutes of a game, Magic Johnson and LeBron and these guys, they're not going to get called for fouls. They can do whatever they want. And so I was like, maybe there's another way. And I remember being in the green room at Sports Reporters, and Ryan and Lupica and the late, great John Saunders, they laughed at me like it was impossible to change this. And yet none of them actually argued with my point.
Right.
Which was, you can't officiate this game anymore.
And if it goes back to this idea that we've been touching on this whole conversation, which is that there's a reason that fouls existed in the first place, right? So Naismith is charged to come up with an indoor game to run off the boys' energy during the winter season. And then he's clearly that they are leaning toward being more physical than less physical because they're used to playing football outside. So, of course, we've got to have these things called fouls. And an added layer of punishment, let's make sure that there's a maximum number you reach and then you can't play anymore. And for that time period, right, I can't say for certain, but maybe that makes sense.
The non-contact sport.
Yeah, to your point, Howard, of like, both the evolution of the game and the human body and society leads us to this place where, does that make any sense for the way we are playing the game now? In addition, Amin, something, you know, we've talked about offline being, does it make sense to the actual physical parameters of a court now with the human body? Like, they can barely hit a corner three without stepping out of bounds. I mean, it's like, what rules should be immutable, to use Howard's word, and which ones should we be flexible on?
So it's funny because the dimensions of the court, even think about the three-point line. Why is the three-point line 23-9 up top and then 22 in the corner? It's not because of any weird math. It's a very simple reason. The court's not wide enough to go 23-9 all the way around. That's why. That's the only reason why. So it's like, well, can we make the court wider? No, that, heaven forbid. It's funny. I always think about what people reject – ideas like yours, Howard, of like, let's change the personal foul limit. Like, what were those people would have been like 50 years ago, 60 years ago, when someone said, guys, we just had a game that ended 1917. This is ridiculous. What if we put a clock right there and it's got like 24 seconds and they got to shoot or else? Preposterous.
I mean, I was watching the Australian Open last night, and Pam Shriver made a reference to the four corners defense. And I was like, I wonder how many people today know what the four corners defense is.
Which was basically, for those of you guys who don't know, it's four corners is like, hey, we're
keep
up.
Keep away.
Yeah, just,
keep
yeah,
away
just
for
hold
10
it,
minutes.
Hold it and pass it. And the guys are in four different corners in the front court. But so it's always funny to me when people say, absolutely not. That's how we've always done it. It's like, do you not understand how many ridiculous, radical rule changes there have been throughout the course of basketball and other sports? For instance, you used to be able to shoot a free throw for as long as you took off from before the free throw line. It didn't matter where you landed. It was all right. You know why they changed that rule? Because Wilt would just run up and dunk from the free throw line. And they're like, okay, we've got to stop that. Right? So there's all types of things that we change because we realize this doesn't work anymore. With regards to your idea about the fouls, Howard, I think one of the reasons why foul outs exist is because, not just because it was a very physical sport once upon a time, Kate, but also we have to make it so that the defense that you play can't be just, well, I'll just foul them.
I'll just crush you, exactly. And that was Ryan's point. Ryan was like, well, you're going to have guys crush each other every 2 minutes.
Well, even if it's not crushing.
Yeah, but I mean, isn't the penalty already baked in with the one and one and two shots? I mean, there's that disincentive to not be fouling.
Sure, that's right. But the problem is, okay, for players, let's say against a Shaquille O'Neal or a Giannis Antetokounmpo or whatever, I'll take that disincentive. I'll let him shoot. And you're telling me I can play my guy the whole game? He doesn't have to leave? That's a problem. I had this conversation with Ethan Strauss a long time ago. Ethan said, free throws are the most boring part of any NBA game. So why don't we just get rid of them? Why don't we just get rid of them? Why don't if the guy gets fouled in the act of shooting, just give him the 2 points. And I said, you think that's going to get rid of guys hunting for free throws? So at the opposite, you're going to get even a more elevated version of people hunting for things. So I want to, like, I guess all this part of the conversation is all about the best intentions of mice and men, right? Like, you know, we want this to be a nice fluid game, but the reality is some of these rules are in place, not because anyone likes it, but because the alternative is for people to act chaotically.
But let's go back to this, right? Let's stay with the NBA. My rationale when we were having this conversation was all about the star system, was about the referees are caught in a political situation. That's Julius Erving. That's Damian Lillard. That's Magic Johnson. I can call a foul on Marcus Smart, but I'm not calling that very same foul on LeBron James, especially in the final 5 minutes of a game. Mm-hmm. Right? So my issue wasn't simply that, okay, the rules have been outstripped by the game, but also that you've got a major problem here because you can't even call the game the way it is.
Howard, not a problem, because nobody at home is watching and say, ooh, I wish Marcus Smart could play a little bit more. But if Damian Lillard fouls out, if LeBron James fouls out, if Magic fouls out, now we have a television problem. Now we have a product problem. And the star system exists because that's what puts bacon on the table.
So we're not even talking at all about actual product of the fairness of the game.
Even we're falling into the default fairness trap, right?
That's
which is This could be more fair, and Amin is here to tell us, sure, it could be more fair, but does it impact the product? Does it impact the bottom line?
Well, it goes back to, once again, the reason for the rules is constantly moving. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, like when you're talking about the product in the NFL, and we're talking about fairness, and we're talking about opportunity and all of these things. Talk to a defensive player over the course of the last 30 years in the NFL. They're like, you don't even want us to play. You don't want us to be part of, we're only on the field because we have to be. So if you're a defensive player, everything in your universe has been to lessen your impact on the sport. And what's been really funny about it is that you go back to the Chiefs and the Bills game, people were complaining, where's the defense? You took the defense away years ago.
You can't touch anybody. And by the way, if you hit a guy too hard or in the wrong place or at the wrong time, all of these carry massive penalties with them. And I'm interested to see how the NFL adjusts, because I think we saw a little bit of that this year in the NBA, where there happened a reinterpretation of some rules, because we began to realize that the offense had too much of an advantage. And part of a beautiful package or a beautiful television product is seeing the offense overcome some sort of resistance. But if we lessen and lessen the impact of defense in the sport, at some point there is no resistance.
But your game's out of balance.
Yeah, it's kind of like the rules, rather than being like immutable and fair, are basically trying to hit some level of a sweet spot, right? It's all about the sweet spot. It's like, where is the product the best, where we're getting the most money for the TV product? People feel like there's defense, but it's not limiting us to 9-7 games.
Right.
And I feel like that's kind of the conversation we were having too on the NBA side, being part of what's baked into the game about having 5 fouls and falling out, or 6 in the NBA, is like, it's a strategy play. It's baked into the strategy. So if you remove it, how does it affect the strategy? And like,
penalty
is there
box
a
in
sweet
basketball.
Spot there? All right, Howard's got another one for us.
Penalty box in basketball. Or you know what? Or how about that? You know what? You are going to be disincentivized to foul if you got 2 shots in the ball or 1 shot and the ball.
Right.
Right? I mean, there are ways to do this, right? There are ways to do it.
They did it in summer league a few years ago, where rather than have guys foul out, you were allowed up to 10 fouls, but every foul after your 6th one, it was like 1 shot in the ball for every foul that you had. So it was kind of a different kind of disincentive structure. This gets me curious as to, for you guys, if you could change any rule in any sport, what would it be?
For me, it's always been basketball, because I feel like the NBA game is actually a fraction of what it, not a fraction, it's a large percentage of the possibility of what it could be. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so much, like the way the game was invented, because we've talked a lot about, you know, Naismith and the original playing of it, there was so much beautiful movement. And not that we've lost that completely. It's been, the movement has been like shifted to the outside more than like backdoor cuts. If you could combine the insane athleticism with movement and open up the court, to me, that has long been, since I covered the Sixers and you're sitting courtside and you're actually seeing up close, as I know we all have, how big those players are and how small that court is and the potential for what basketball could look like, it feels like it's a no-brainer in the next 20 years to like expand that.
All right, I'm going to start yelling at the clouds right now. And I don't care if anybody's mad at me for yelling at them, because they're my clouds, okay? I would get rid of the 3-point shot. And the reason why I would get... hear me out. I'm not even starting. Here's why I would get rid of it. I grew up with basketball as a game of makes. Very simple. If you were a good offensive player, you made half your shots and you made 80% of your free throws, right? I mean, that was a good offensive player. Like, even if you go back, and I'm an 80s guy, so I'm not a 90s guy, so I'm not used to John Starks and shooting 40% from the field. Sorry, Chris Herring. But it's, I mean, and also Kay Fagan 3. Sorry about that, John Starks.
Yeah, for those of you who don't know, John Starks is my guy. He's my childhood basketball hero. So thank you, Howard, for the name check there.
Right? I am absolutely into the 80s. I mean, yeah, Doug Moe went a little too far with 126 a game while giving up 125 with the 81-82 Nuggets. But at the same time, basketball has now turned into a game of misses. And I don't watch the game for misses. I watch the games for high efficiency makes. And the way that this game is now, when you're going 9 for 27 from three, and that the word efficiency now is based, it's not based on making shots. It's based on the amount of twos you have to make to compensate for the extra point. But what's being lost in here is the aesthetic of we're just watching so many goddamn misses. They're just clanking the ball up and down. So I'm like, okay. I also remember the late 90s and the Celtics and the Knicks and the Pistons beating the hell out of each other and clogging the lane to the point where the game bogged down there, which brought us into the 90s. Mm-hmm. So somewhere along the line, I wonder what that compromise could be, because that game brought us into the 90s, Knicks and Pacers scoring 140 points combined. But what we have today, it's a three-point shooting contest. And so somewhere I'm trying to find out what that balance is going to be. With the way these guys can shoot today, with the size and the fact that positions don't even exist anymore, not having your entire offense tied to a 1-4 high, everybody shoot the three or circle, you know, ring the three-point line, maybe you'd have a lot more mid-range. Maybe you'd have a lot more space. Maybe you'd get better shooting. I don't know.
And before we go to you, is it possible that opening up the court is a partial solve for what Howard's talking about? Because there's some disincentive to be to the mid-range game because they're so crowded everywhere you move on the floor. Like, there's more space the farther out you get.
Yeah, I disagree with Howard, but and I realize
you can do that.
He said he was yelling at the clouds.
No, I know, and it's funny. It's like, hey, if you could do anything, what would it be? And then I immediately want to say, I want to be one of those people. You're nuts, Howard Bryant. What are you talking about?
No, it is a game of misses now, right? I mean, this is what the game
is built on. And I think two things have happened. One is the players are, as we said earlier, bigger, faster, stronger, more athletic. They cover ground in a way they didn't even
do. Yeah, their length,
ago,
absolutely. Right?
That's one part of it. The other part of it is, as I think defenses and particularly defensive strategies have advanced massively, because what happened in the 90s was, as the money came in from the TV deals, teams that in the 80s used to have two assistant coaches now have four and five, right? And you've got guys whose their whole job is, I'm just watching these three teams, what offenses they're running on a nightly basis, what are the play calls they're doing, what are the play calls called, where do they like? And so the preparation levels of NBA teams today, through technology, through just a bigger budget, is so much larger than it was even in the 1980s that it's so hard for our star players to do what they do because the defenses are so too good. So you got to have something, some sort of disincentive to pull away. Because if you take away that line, and it's a difference between me watching, say, for instance, Joel Embiid dunk it or Seth Curry attempt a mid-range jumper, I'm going to, like, they're both 2 points, but one of them has a much higher likelihood. So I'm going to do everything in my power to not let this one happen.
Isn't that what's happening now?
But the difference is the threat that happens with a Seth Curry or whoever is that when he hits his shot, he gets an extra point on top of that. So now I have to do a very real calculus of, okay, what's worse, a short thing right there or a kind of short thing over there, but that carries a larger point.
Not even close to a sure thing. I mean, what? I mean, nobody shoots 36, 37% from three. What's Steph shooting from three now?
So let me stick with Seth because it illustrates like the either or the pick your poison. Seth Curry shoots 41.7 from three, right? But if you were to take that and pull his effective field goal percentage on those shots, that's basically taking his makes and realizing that instead of counting for 2 points, to count for a point and a half above that, overall his effective field goal percentage is at 60%. That's with his 2 point makes as well. So it really is a much higher proposition of, it's a lot closer to one another, the Embiid dunk or the Seth Curry three. Now, the problem is, not everyone's Seth Curry.
I was going to say, what happens when you start adding everybody else to this? What happens to the aesthetic of the sport? And I remember talking to Tom Thibodeau about this when he was working for ESPN. We're in the green room one day, and I'm like, Tibbs, what is happening with this sport? He goes, well, the analytics of the sport say that there are only two shots you're trying to get. You're trying to get a dunk and a corner three. That's what we're trying to get on pretty much every trip down court. Those are the open shots based on where the defenses are.
Yes, but also that's what based on what the defense is giving you, a lot of times that's what happens. But I would disagree with Tibbs in this way. To me, the three-point shot is not about being a three-pointer for the sake of being a three-pointer. The three-point shot is about how do I make defenses respect the other non-stars on the floor enough to let my stars do what they do, whether it's a three-pointer, a mid-range shot, or in the paint. I want my LeBrons, my Kevin Durant, those guys, to be unfettered by this guy's hanging out like, hey, you know, I'm not really guarding my man, so I guess I would help out over here. To me, and this leads me to my proposed rule change, and I stole this from someone. I don't remember who it was. I think it's Tom Haverstraw.
It's not even your rule change.
It's not even my rule change. I like the idea that every home team gets to set where the three-point line is. I love this idea because if you're Milwaukee, you could say, when you come to Fiserv, the three-point line is the restricted area.
So you want to go old-time hockey baseball where every arena has different dimensions.
Yes, absolutely, because I want teams
width of court as well?
I mean, no. Well, maybe, I don't know. Let's throw it up there. Yeah, why am I fighting that? Yeah, sure, why not? Why not? But the whole idea is, you know, I kind of, in a weird way, admire baseball and the fact that all the stadiums are different, all the fields are different, and as a result, the front office calculus and how we build our roster takes that into account in a way that's that right. In other sports, we're just putting the best 26-man, 53-man, 15-man roster we can. So I like the idea, like, no, there's a little added level of strategy here, like, oh, if I've got a guy like Giannis who is unstoppable and has high volume right here, why wouldn't I want to exploit that versus if I'm a team like, say, the Golden State Warriors, where I shoot a lot of threes, I don't have a lot of inside might. I want that three-point line as far out as possible to make sure that the other team can't keep up with what we can do in both volume and accuracy from that distance.
That is outstanding. You know what? I am very, very happy that you ridiculed with my short-sighted vision, and you introduced that because that would be amazingly fun. What it would also do is it would radically change rosters. The only thing that I would suggest is, are basketball players that diverse that you would have really different rosters, right? Like when you're looking at the 87 Twins or the 82 Cardinals playing on AstroTurf, those teams, those players, you had to get different types of players. Whereas if you were playing at Wrigley Field, if you were the Cubs or the Red Sox or the Orioles, you were looking at boppers because you had a short fence and those guys couldn't run. They didn't steal bases. They were just trying to hit the ball over the fence because they were playing to their ballpark.
I submit to you that the players are whatever the rules say they are. Just like 20 years ago, we didn't have anybody big really shoot. There was a couple of outliers like Sam Perkins and guys like that shooting threes. Yeah. But once we started saying, this is important, what do you get? You get a generation of seven-footers that all play out there. They'll do whatever we tell them is important to do. That's why we have so many players who want to be three-point shooters.
I think we've landed at like a larger theme here once again, being that like the rules seem to reflect society and reinforce it. Because, I mean, you could make an argument that the death of the mid-range is also correlated with like the death of the middle class in America. Like this idea of three-pointers, all or nothing. The polarization of the U.S. seems to also be reflected in the way our sports have played out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, baseball too, right?
Same thing. And that's why they're not playing right now. Let's finish with the NFL. Let's go to this specifically. This is what started this whole conversation, and we haven't really even talked about it. When we talk about fairness and we talk about intention, the purpose of the overtime rule, to my mind, had always been, at least ostensibly, that both teams would get a chance to touch the football. That the reason why you brought in this overtime rule was because losing on a first possession field goal was kind of trash, right? And that you're creating this half measure that, okay, the argument that people are saying against this overtime rule with both teams touching the ball, whatever, is get a stop, right? How many times have we heard this? Well, stop the ball, you know, get a stop, and then we're not talking about overtime. You had 13 seconds to kill and you were on your own 25-yard line. That is all well and good, but that's not discussing the actual rule that we're talking about, right? So the rule itself is a half measure. On the one hand, yeah, it kind of sucks to lose on a first possession field goal. But on the other hand, we don't want defense to mean nothing. So yes, if you give up a touchdown, then that's on you. Which doesn't really answer the fairness question of should I have a chance to touch the football? Now, to Kate's point of maybe none of this really works well. What do you do if you get the ball on the 25-yard line and you have a 12-play, 14-minute drive? The other team's not getting the ball anyway, right?
So, why is there a clock? Someone asked that the other day.
Why is there a clock? In overtime. So my question is, what is the goal here when you're thinking about this game, when you're watching this game specifically? To me, I felt like, all right, if you're going to have a rule that's designed for both teams to touch the ball, then both teams should get the ball. That's it, right? Whether you score a touchdown, whether you score a field goal, what the NFL seems to be doing in this overtime rule is to say one score, one type of score is more legitimate than another type of score. A touchdown is a definitive game ender, but a field goal really isn't. And that's what leaves me cold.
Yeah. It seems like the NFL is doing everything it can to not find itself in a situation that soccer has always found itself. Like, they don't want an end of game that is like, all right, let's just kick best of five field goals here. They can't have that. And then at the same time, it seems to me that there is this feeling of football is very difficult and we can't just play it forever. So we want to put certain parameters in place to get to a resolution before we're just like little tackling dummies out there and we don't even feel like we have our best product anyway. And it feels like they're trying to thread the needle on something to the point in the beginning where I don't know that you're ever going to be able to thread it.
Right. I love the evolution of what overtime rules were and how they got here. We got here because people were, as Howard said, because people were winning a coin toss.
Yep.
They won a coin flip and that's how they won it, right? And before that, we got there because people were playing 7 million overtimes, right? The overtime would just never end because teams were getting stop after stop or whatever. The other part of this that's funny is you don't want to be soccer, but you know who else they don't want to be? College football.
They don't want to be college football.
There is such a weird dynamic between pro and college sports. In there, there's a symbiosis of we need each other. And then there's also this, oh, I don't do it like that. That's how they do it over there. And so the idea that in college football, hey, each team gets a possession or whatever it is. And you get a try, four
from
downs.
From the 25-yard line.
And you just keep going.
You score a touchdown, cool. Now it's your turn. If we want to stop you or whatever, then that's it. That seems to me like a pretty good system, right?
But since they already have it, it's off the table. And that's a weird place for the NFL to be.
That's how they do it over there. We'll never do it over here. That's the needle you're talking about threading. There's a second needle that you have to also thread, which is also has to be something that they're not doing over there.
So that's just your ego. That's just ego talking.
Yep.
Well, isn't that what all of this is about?
It's always the way it is.
All the rules are about ego on some level, right? The idea like, no, we're not going to do it like that because A, we've always done it this way. That's ego. Or B, because that's how they do it over there. We don't respect them.
That's right. But to the get a stop people, giving up a field goal isn't getting a stop either.
Yeah.
So that doesn't quite answer it. And I just sort of feel like when you're looking at the intention of this overtime rule, I think you're right, kid. I think when it comes to football, because you can hold the ball, it's not like baseball where, okay, you get your three outs at the top of the 10th and I get my three outs at the bottom of the 10th because it's not based on outs, it's based on time. So what you would have to do if you were going to do it this way in the NFL was you couldn't have a clock. You get your possession, whether it's 10 plays, 10 minutes, or whether it's 3 plays, 2 minutes, and then I get my turn. And then we go from there, that you actually have an untimed overtime if that's how you really want to do it. If your goal is fairness.
I can't believe we've gone this far and I forgot about the most important rule change of all time, where Stu Gatz says, in baseball, we should have one extra inning. And if after 10 innings, we don't have a winner, home run derby.
Home run
soccer
derby.
Soccer style shooter, yeah. And you know what?
I just like Roy Wood Jr. who just says, fight.
Hey everybody, it's Mike, and typically I record these Miller Lite spots in the studio, but I requested that I specifically record this one from my home office because I got a window, and I'm looking outside at those beautiful fishtail palms, knowing that in just a few seconds, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to crack open a can of Miller Lite, because while sitting outside by my fishtail palms is usually a good time, I like to take it up a notch and make it a Miller time. That's right, you crack that puppy open, and you don't have to think about what you're drinking for a darn second. A lot has changed over the years, including my backyard. Lots of landscaping being done right now. But the one thing that hasn't changed is the undebatable quality of Miller Lite. You don't have to choose what quality is the best. Miller Lite has great taste and it's less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces, fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.